I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best of motor racing.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the March Motorsport podcast, which, of course, is our pre-season podcast, the first qualifying session for the first Grand Prix of the year, getting underway in just 4 days' time in Bahrain. And especially welcome today to Damon Hill, the 1996 Formula One world champion and the president of the British Racing Drivers Club. And he'll be talking a bit later on about the British Grand Prix coming safely to Silverstone for 17 years. Fantastic news. And in fact, when he got here today, Damon was telling us that he used to be a dispatch rider just down the road from us here in Lotts Road in London. So that's how far this guy came. Let's ask you first of all, Damon, and thank you very much for coming. Who's going to win the world championship?
Thankfully, that's a good question we don't know the answer to. I think this year is shaping up to be something quite unpredictable, actually. It's quite difficult to put your finger on where the strong points are, because there are there's such a strength in depth of drivers as well, and they all seem to be paired up in the right way. It's quite unlike a season that I've seen for a long time in that respect. So
much stronger driving force, if I can use that phrase, than we've seen for many years, I'd say. Yes.
Yeah, I think so. If you add up the number of drivers who have actually won Grand Prix, I'm not sure, but someone will tell me if I'm wrong, but I get the feeling we've got pairings of drivers who've been in contention for world championships throughout the field, which is very unusual.
Absolutely. So who's going to win it?
Yeah, right. I still think Lewis is... He seems to be confident. I mean, I have not heard noises that are grumblings about the car particularly, and I think that they were looking good at the end of last year. So a strong pairing between Jensen and Lewis, but that's going to be an interesting story to see that unfold.
They've said in the past, drivers always say that when they that first test when they get in the car, they know within a lap whether it's a good car or not.
Yeah.
Is that how you remember it?
Well, I'm not sure about a lap, but some drivers maybe could do that. But I certainly was, I'm always, when I approached it, I was looking all the time at signs of deceiving yourself, because you always, there's a lot of wishful thinking involved sometimes in turning up with a new car. Yeah. You so want it to be good, you could class but all sorts of drawers, but there's no way of knowing until you've done quite a lot of testing and all the other guys have turned up, and then you don't know, because you don't know quite what they're up to either. So that's the great thing about the first race.
So I mean, going by that, Alonso is obviously very happy with his car, and he's come out and said, you know, this is the best car I've had ever. So you can't discount him, I don't think, ever, but especially since he's in a Ferrari.
Mr. Roebuck.
No, I don't think you can ever discount Alonso. But you know, the thing that struck me is everybody's tended to concentrate. Everybody's sort of said, "Well, there are four. There are going to be four top teams: Ferrari, McLaren, Red Bull, Mercedes." And everybody's kind of singled out Lewis, Fernando, Michael, and Vettel as if, you know, it's going to be those four. Sort of almost discounting the other driver in each team. And I think, yeah, how the hell can you do that with people like, you know, like Massa?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Jensen.
We haven't actually uttered the S word so far, and we've got to talk about Michael Schumacher, especially with the man sitting here on my left. What's your take on him coming back? I mean, you're not going to do that, are you?
I actually retired when I was 39, so I was on my way out, and he's on his way back in for a second go. But he hasn't been out for that long, and I think he's obviously been looking for some way of fulfilling that gap that motorsport filled in your life, he hasn't been away that long, so I think he's still young enough. I think particularly someone like Michael, who loves being fit anyway, he's sort of he always was incredibly fit. He used to get out of the car with not a bead of sweat on, which was incredibly frustrating. I don't know. So, I mean, 41 years old is a spring chicken, really.
What's it like when you step away from Formula One, when you've been in that intense environment for so long, and then suddenly you're out of it?
Well, I think it depends on how much of a bellyful you've had of it. because it's not just the driving, as you know. So I think there are certain objectives you might have in your mind to achieve. And for me, I felt like I fulfilled as much as I possibly could do. And I couldn't see that I was enjoying myself. So it was quite easy to walk away from it. But to find something else that gives you that buzz. I did find myself rather oddly on race weekends for my first year out where I wasn't racing. And I found myself in the woods, because we had some woods, with a chainsaw. The only way I could interpret this was that I obviously felt the need to have a machine in my hands. There was obviously a deep-seated need to get your hands on it. But I was very mindful of lots of problems that drivers have had in replacing that gap. And quite often they've taken to rather reckless pursuits, with tragic results in many cases. Mm-hmm. And I very much, I think probably because of what happened in my life with my dad retiring and having an accident, I really was very concerned for my family. You know, as a driver, I think that for me there was something which I wanted to stay away from, reckless things. So I took up golf, and it's a nightmare. I'd much rather be driving a car, to be honest. I'm much better at that.
Yeah. Did you lose it? I mean, that sort of, obviously Michael has a very, very fundamental need to compete.
Yeah, I think this is it, Nigel.
Did you ever consider doing, I don't know, DTM or anything else once you'd stopped Formula One?
I think there is, for me there definitely was, the beauty of F1, Nigel, is that it is the best. It's the very top, it's the very best. And in my mind, I reached the peak of anything I could ever expect from myself in doing that. Sure. And within that realm of Formula One, where you're driving the best cars with the best designers, the best teams on the best circuits, it was the best. So anything less than that is very difficult to get motivated to give your best for, you know, because it's not, and I realize that in myself as a driver. You peak and you think, if you can't get back to that peak again, you just think, well, I'm not as good as I was. And this is something where I think where Michael, he's going to be finding, he'll be trying to get back to where he was, but I just don't think he'll ever get back to the point where what Stirling described as driving by the seat of your pants, that thing where it's all instinctive. And if he doesn't get that, then he'll be under par, and whether or not he can be satisfied with that, I don't know.
No, I just wanted to add in. Mario Andretti was saying, you know, he's thrilled to bits. He's coming back and saying, "Jesus, 41. I wasn't even thinking about stopping." Mm. But he said, you know, I know he's super fit, and I can't see that being a problem. But he said the one thing you can't do anything about as you get older is the recovery time from a race weekend. He said, you know, in your 20s, you're over it. Monday morning, you wake up, you don't feel too bad at all.
And you've
Monday
been out
afternoon,
all
you're
well.
Fine. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But he said, but as you get older, that's the bit. You become aware you're not recovering from a race weekend as quickly as you did. And he said, I just wonder if Michael, there are four back to backs this year, and I wonder if Michael might play a bit of a role there.
It depends how much you've given of yourself in those events. If you've got a good car and you you get in the front and the car's doing the work, then it's not so demanding. If you are, I was always staggered with Michael the number of championships he could withstand, because, I mean, you know, you knew Alain, and a lot of drivers have been champions. You know, the strain of being a world champion or leading the championship, Lewis has realised that, Jensen's realised that. It's a big strain, and Michael did it year on year, and I don't know how he coped with the psychological strain.
Well, it's freaky, isn't it? It's freaky, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, it's unusual, isn't it?
I won't use the word freaky, but, I mean, I can see what you mean. It is a certain single-mindedness, which perhaps is that's where it becomes slightly questionable as to whether it's healthy to be devoting yourself to one specific thing only in your life, you know, because there's a penalty to be paid if you don't have that thing.
I suppose if it never crosses your mind that anybody else is anything like as good as you are, that probably helps as well.
I never quite mastered that one myself, but I always thought someone out there better than me, but and it was Michael.
We mustn't dwell for too long on Michael Schumacher, but I think we should ask you about, you had some very close contact with the man on the racing circuit.
Too close, yes.
Yes, far too close. I mean, allegedly, he punted you off. Do you think that the stewards of today, who are slightly different from the type of steward we had before, will jump on him very quickly if he comes back to those kind of tactics?
Well, I think, Rob, there's some interesting dynamics here. I mean, we've got his old team boss is now head of the FIA, and his previous team boss he's driving for in a different team. So you've got friends in high places if you need them. But that was always the concern, I think, with Michael's era, was whether or not there was due concern given to even kind of penalties and consistent penalties throughout that period, and I think that he's suffered a little bit from the legacy of that, in that sometimes people have said, well, you know, you it's not the same penalty if you take someone's points away for knocking someone off when they've come second as if you take the points away from when they win the championship, so, and do the same thing. So that era has now changed with a change at the top of the FIA.
Yeah.
I think Jean is very I think it would be interesting to see how he plays his hand over Formula One, and I think that it'll be very important for the FIA to be seen to be treating Formula One as a sport and being absolutely fair in their dishing out of whatever punishments that come along from time to time, and not being over heavy on some people rather than others. That is, for my mind, is going to be the interesting new development in Formula One for the next period of time. I mean, not just this year, but under new management.
That's interesting.
I remember you telling me long ago. You were telling me. When you were in the junior formula, and you said, and everybody was looking at Senna and what Senna was doing in Formula One and getting away with,
yes,
and that influenced everybody.
Yes, and it's been an issue, I think, for this sport, the consistency of the way it's adjudicated things. And now I believe that Jean is interested in getting driver input into decisions that are made about driving, and I think that's a good step. I think that for too long I feel that the drivers have got a massive contribution to make to this sport, and there needs to be a mechanism whereby their contribution can be heard and included in the mix of decision making.
Yeah,
I think it's good, positive stuff. Yeah. I'm pleased to hear you say that. I mean, I get the impression that you're certainly ready for Jean Todt to be a more positive person at the top of the FIA.
Yeah, I think I from what I can see, I think that he is considering how the image of the sport can be improved. And I think the image of the sport is very, very important to everyone. Not only just to, you know, our satisfaction as spectators and fans and whatever, and competitors, but also because as a business, I think that it suffered a little bit in recent times, because people look at it and think, well, hang on, is this just a show or is this a sport? You know, where
exactly?
It just brings us very neatly onto Silverstone. As I said at the beginning, you're president of the British Racing Drivers Club, and you have played a part in saving the British Grand Prix, i.e. keeping it at Silverstone, and not only that, but for another 17 years. Can you tell us briefly how you turned, I mean, not you personally, but how Silverstone turned this situation around?
I think there was always constant pressure to see what we needed to do to make the circumstances right for the contract to come back. But at the same time, we did not have any influence over what Donington were doing, and there was things that are, there are things that are out of your hand, you know, as in many cases they're situated, a lot of it is out of your hands, and so there's a bit of luck involved, or a bit of bad luck, unfortunately, with Donington, that they weren't able to fulfil their end of it, and it just came back to Silverstone that way. But constant pressure, trying to inform people who had influence on decisions, the reasons why Silverstone was best for a venue, and that's a long story, and sometimes people haven't got time to listen to the whole story.
But I mean, if you didn't get the 17-year contract, do you think we'd still have the British Grand Prix at Silverstone? I mean, if we didn't get such a long...
Yeah, I know. The option is to have a 10-year contract with an extension at seven. So the option is there for 17 years. Yeah. But the good news, I think, or the important thing for Silverstone, for any venue, is to have some long-term plan. 5 years is very difficult for a big capital expenditure if you don't know if you're going to have a contract in 5 years' time. That was the last length of the contract. Mm. And so the sport needs venues. Now, this is something that I'm quite forceful on. I think I don't understand. I mean, in the absence of another suitable venue in the UK... it would make sense to invest in what our one and only venue and make it the best motorsport venue. I mean, motorsport has done this country proud, and I think that so the success of Great Britain on the world stage has shown off our talents very well, and Silverstone really is the shop front, is the way of showing that. So the venue is very important, both from how it appears to the world and caters for fans and spectators and gives them the best show, but also how good it is as a driver challenge as well. That's really strong on that, you know, and I've been working really hard to try and make sure we don't lose the driver challenge of these circuits.
Absolutely.
Are you, I mean, as a motorcycle racer and a car racer, you have a fantastic insight into how a circuit should be, and bearing in mind that, you know, Silverstone has both formats. Are you happy that the revised layout will be good for motorcycle racing?
Well, the revised layout was primarily
for the bikes,
for the bikes,
yeah.
Because
but now
the time we with the just to explain that. So listeners weren't aware that there was the period where we didn't have a Formula One contract, but the only contract we had was the MotoGP. Yeah. So we've rearranged the circuit, but always within mind, making it as good as possible for Formula One cars and for racing cars as well. So it's a little bit of compromise has to come into play, because there's a difference in philosophy regarding corner entries with bikes. They don't like certain layouts that. The particularly corners that tighten up, which is actually quite a good corner for a car.
Yeah.
So the how you get the mix right is quite a challenge, and I'm still not sure that the science has been thoroughly worked through yet.
That's what I meant. Sorry, it was a badly phrased question. That's what I was.
Well, I think I answer whatever the gist of it was.
Yes, you have. Good. I mean, that's what I meant. Is it going to be a great circuit for both? And can a circuit ever be great for both? That's what I was really.
Well, I don't know. It is a problem, because you don't want to have separate venues really for motorsport, because you know, motorsport, it's not. It can't happen in the city centres. You know, it needs the venues are few and far between of any calibre, and so you want to build them up into places that are good for both. I mean. They used to race. I mean, they raced. Do they still race Daytona bikes?
Yeah,
I mean, obviously, famously, Barry went off there. But
motorsport.
It's a curious one, isn't it? Because motorsport, umbrella term for everything with an engine in it. But there are so many different varieties, and the people that will go to a touring car race won't necessarily go to a Formula One race. And the crossover is not automatic at all. But so we're going to get a different crowd at Silverstone for the bikes, and we try. Well, they're trying to change the flavour of the event as well, so to cater for that.
I must say, I was in the Midlands at the weekend, and I don't know if you saw it, but it was on the local news last night. Yesterday at Donington, there was
Yes, Donington Day.
And I haven't been to Donington since it was torn up, but I mean, it just really did make you want to weep. And I look back now to that morning at Silverstone in 08, when, you know, with gratuitous cruelty, the FIA announced
the birthday present.
Absolutely, yeah, birthday present. Yeah. But I remember that day, Damon, talking to sundry people in the paddock, I mean, and one of whom, I won't say who it was, but it was somebody extremely close to Bernie. And I said, what is this all about? This is a joke, isn't it? And he just said, what a wicked thing to say. That was the day it was announced. Yeah. So from that day on, I don't think anybody, and you know, and where's the money coming from? Debentures. Jesus, you know. I don't think any, but my point is, I don't think the racing community from the first day took it seriously. So then you have to ask yourself, what the hell has this all been about? Mm. What has it achieved, apart from the mutilation of a nice circuit?
Yeah, there's a casualty. And there's a casualty, absolutely. And you have to ask, why has there been a casualty? We've had in this country and around the world, everyone's had the same experience with sort of rampant commercialism, and there's a casualty to that. That's why there needs to be in place someone or somebody which is pleading the case for some sort of balanced approach to it. Mm. You know, it can't all be one way. It just leads to those kind of things. It's a tragic thing that Donington is in the state it's in. I mean, particularly. So tragic that Tom, would have gone out seeing his place in such a wreck. Now, that's not a nice thing at all to have happened to anyone. But, you know, we can't, I've heard you say it enough times, Nigel, you know, and written it, you know, we can't be sentimental in this sport. You know, it's a business and there are business reasons. And this is always the thing that's put forward, isn't it?
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm probably more sentimental about this sport than most people. I wish it's something you're sort of almost stuck with, and people just say, "Oh, well, you're a purist."
I think
motor racing, I think it pays such scant regard and attention to its heritage, its history, and I think if you compare it with a sport like golf, where I mean, you know, someone like Jack Nicklaus will be revered in America to the day he dies.
They respect their history.
They do.
Utterly. And you're asked to respect the culture of the game. Now, okay, it's difficult to get people to turn on, who like motorsport, to turn on to that kind of idea, because golf is a very different culture.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But the respect that is afforded those competitors, the game, the rules, and the conduct. Now, motorsport has always been a bad boy sport, you know. In comparison, it's been for people who are kind of slightly misfit, perhaps you might say. Yep. It's created itself. Golf's been going a lot longer than motor racing, but it has been a bandit kind of territory for a lot of people for a long time. And that was fine, but now it's sort of trying to corporatize itself and make itself attractive to people who like to have a squeaky clean image, like banks and institutions. Now, of course, and then we come back to the beginning again. So this is an issue. I mean, you can't, if you're going to go always to the highest bidder, you've got to ask yourself, well, hang on, what am I actually giving up for what I'm getting? And if you're giving up complete control of things that you understand best, and you feel you are instigates this commodity in the first place, then you're going to kill it, because it'll just go up in a sort of accountant's spreadsheet somewhere.
Absolutely. The sort of ultimate example of this in many ways is NASCAR, which has become as corporate as it gets. Mm. But I mean, NASCAR's history is extremely rich, you know, starting with the people, you know, the original stars were people who you know, ran moonshine. That was where they learned how to drive. And that's all very carefully now airbrushed out of history.
Yeah.
And if you go to Daytona, you can buy books about NASCAR at Daytona. You won't find a single book about that era.
Mm. No, that's very... It is,
and a lot of...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The fans are very sad that it's been...
It's a very interesting question. There was a good documentary by... I forget the man's name, sorry. But it was about Las Vegas, about the history of Las Vegas. Yeah. A similar thing.
Yeah.
You know, it was started by, creative people. creative accountants. Right. And now what they're trying to do is tidy up Las Vegas.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we're in the era of trying to make things look awfully marketable, which is to the detriment, I think, of the sport, because drivers who used to be the characters that people loved are now careful to what they say, and they tend to hide behind their contracts.
Yeah.
And they can get on with their job, and they get and I'm not, I don't want to criticize them, because they didn't create the system. No. It's not their problem as such, but I did feel as a driver, I always felt there's an element of this which is of expressing yourself in public. Correct. You know, it's expressing who you are and what you're about. And I was very lucky to drive for a team like Williams, because Frank never told me what to say or what not to say.
And Patrick always said what he thought anyway.
Exactly. And they could disagree with me, but I always felt like I could, at least if I wanted to. I never had anything in my contract saying you can't say this, you can't say that. And having, obviously, my dad was a big hero, for me anyway, and I think people liked his charisma, and I think people liked drivers with charisma, like Mario Andretti.
Absolutely.
And this was the big appeal for the sport. Yeah, that's where the money comes in, because people can't talk to a car. You know, they're beautiful things, but you know...
That's the extraordinary thing. If you're at Daytona now, and Richard Petty... You know, his name is sort of announced to the crowd and all the rest of it. Yeah. You know, they just sort of, they go nuts.
Utterly.
Yeah. Even as recently, I mean, Kimi Räikkönen, he said absolutely nothing. You know, you got one word answers from him if you can ask him a question. But still, people absolutely loved him because he was a bit different. You know, and even just that tiny little difference.
You can't have a sport where people can't relate to heroes and villains. It's a non-starter. You've got to. It's the same with football. I mean, you know, it's like James Hunt and Niki Lauda, or Damon Hill and Michael Schumacher. I mean, this is the whole appeal.
It's reality TV. It's almost, you know, it is, sport is... really, it's a living play where there's no script, and it's life. You know, it's right there in front of you. And of course, the more you can have bad elements, which are, I mean, there were periods in Formula One's history where drivers were punching marshals and things like that. Mm. Now, you can have a look at that. I think that was very entertaining at one time. You know, Piquet Salazar and all this stuff. You know, and there's good and bad, but that's the show. And within that context, it's possible also to conduct yourself well if you want to be like that.
Absolutely.
Okay, but if everyone's pretending to be conducting themselves well because it says in the contract, then people sniff that. They don't.
Absolutely.
They get it, and they know that's not real. That's not. And you'll get what happened in the music business in the 70s, which was there was a revolution, and punk rock came along.
Yes, yes, sure.
And it all started again.
Yeah.
Because people, it gets top heavy, and I think that's the danger with Formula One at the moment. Is it's sort of lost direction. It's sort of punting around a little bit to find out what people like, and you think, well, hang on, if you don't know yourself, then maybe you shouldn't be running.
But it seems quite sort of recent. thing that if somebody's actually cottoned on them, well, for a start, they like overtaking. You know, the FIA actually discusses it these days. For all those years, Max would sort of say, no, no, we should think of it like a chess match. So that's, I think that's progress of a kind.
Yeah, it's a long debate.
We have got to take some of our readers' and listeners' questions, and not that we don't want to, but we've been inundated with them for Damon's programme, so we're not going to get through all of them. But one I do like is, are you aware, Damon, that 1,000 people on Facebook would like to see one of the new corners at Silverstone named after Murray Walker?
Walker Corner.
Walker Corner.
Yeah, we are. Well, we've actually just gone through the corner naming process. I'm afraid we didn't have that one earlier because it might be too late to factor that one in, but I will pass it on to the board and we'll have a long discussion about it.
I'm very, very pleased that we have taken this question, which comes from somebody called Pete, just Pete. Yeah. I guess that's Facebook stuff, isn't it? You're only Pete on Facebook.
Have you decided on the
maybe we should. Murray is to this country. He's a living legend. I mean, because he communicates that enthusiasm. Yeah. That's exactly what we've been talking about today. Yeah.
Did he do that in Suzuka?
No, I think he's a genius. Him and he could make a dreary procession of an afternoon.
A childish, absolute wow factor where you kind of still get the buzz. And I think that's God bless him.
Okay. No, I agree.
Right. Well, if you don't mind, we're going to just ask you a couple more from these. Your best ever drive, Damon. Difficult one, I know, because you've got to start thinking back. Mm. But Peter Guerin reckons it was Suzuka 94.
Absolutely. Because it had all the factors. I think you could say that it had all the factors there that made it a necessity in every way to perform to the best I could. So, and I shouldn't really make these sort of confessions, but I think I was quite a lazy driver in the sense that I always seemed to leave it to the last minute. I had to have massive pressure to drag it out of me. Patrick would be busting a blood vessel, and frankly, but if he could have bit his nails, he would have done. But and they'd be going, oh, when is he going to do it? You know, and I'd just go, just wait until there's 2 minutes to go, and on, and then I do it. And I actually, so Suzuka was like a last ditch attempt to save your life, sort of thing. The championship, I needed to beat him, and it was the most. It was very thrilling because the conditions were absolutely appalling, and I remember going along behind Michael. And thinking, I can see his red light. And I was thinking, if I can't see that red light, he's gone. I've got to see that red light. So I was just hanging on to the light. And it was like, follow the light. You know, literally, I didn't know what I was doing driving the car. I was just following his light. And then they had the restart and I went out. I had no light to follow after that. I got the countdown that he was catching me. And I was thinking, I've got a little bit more. I can just measure it out. And then the last few laps, I just went like a... I just gave everything I could to it, and
it was an incredible day. And of course, it was at that time. It was there was no question of right stops new race.
No,
it was it was this aggregate thing.
Yeah,
and so that was what kept everybody such buzzing sort of.
Yeah,
he needs another second.
There was a screen. Around the back of the circuit, and I could see Michael. Sorry, I could see John Lacey and Murray Walker. Ooh, Murray Walker. I'm not trying to. That's word association. I got myself muddled up. I meant to say Nigel Mansell, of course, because they're obviously glued together in my head. But there was Nigel. So I was arriving around, and I was actually watching the race with Nigel and John as well, because he was all over the back of him, wasn't he, in that race? Yeah. I think that I sort of in that race left a little bit of a marker in Michael's head that I think he thought to himself, well, actually, maybe I did enough to kind of to warrant a little bit of respect from him there. But And it carried on in Adelaide. The great thing was it just went straight to Adelaide. It was like race, the final championship race part two, because we just jumped in the car and it went straight to the next bit.
You seem to find another level at Suzuka and Adelaide.
Yeah.
Is that how it appeared to you at the time?
Yeah, it was in a different level. And that, when I was talking earlier about driving at a level, I mean, to recreate the necessity to drive at that, I know I couldn't have done that year in, year out. I mean, it was a pitch of driving which was sort of, I mean, you used to hear Ayrton talk about not knowing what he was doing, you know, and I honestly believe that I got to that point in that race where I actually just was willing things to happen, and fantastic to watch Michael driving close up in the wet as well, because the guy is a genius in a car. I followed lots of guys racing, and they normally make a mistake and then you know they're going to go off, and he made loads of mistakes and went off, and he came back on again, you know, which is sort of framed my thinking for what happened in Adelaide. You know, extraordinary talent, seat of the pants driving, just sheer ability to drive on the edge the whole time.
Do you think, Damon, that your motorcycle racing made you a better wet weather Grand Prix driver?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I used to like riding in the wet. And I mentioned to you earlier being a dispatch rider. I mean, running around London on a motorbike in the wet, you learn to get used to slipperiness. You know, Belgrave Square after a nice light drizzle, and you used to be able to sort of two wheel drift it down there. And
they normally talk about Casino Square. Today we have
but you know all the greasy spots in London there, I think it gave me that feel for what the rear wheel's doing, the breakaway point.
Do you think that Valentino Rossi would be a great Grand Prix driver? Do you have a feel for? I mean, he's utterly remarkable on a motorcycle, isn't he?
No, all I can say is going from bikes to cars, I felt I really didn't enjoy the experience of driving to start with. And the only time I felt very claustrophobic, not being able to move my legs. You know, every time I went around a corner, I was trying to. In fact, I used to get bruises on my knees because I used to try and put my knee out automatically. So claustrophobic, and also they rattled and they buzzed and they didn't go. And the only time I got anywhere near the power to weight ratio or power to grip ratio in cars was when I went to 3,000 cars, and that was more like a TZ 350. You know, because TZ 350 had quite a lot of torque and only a small contact patch. So you could drive on that edge.
And that's when your career really took off, wasn't it? Because that year, that Lola, you didn't finish many of the races, but you led most of them.
It was a good car. But up until that time, Formula 3, I only really went well when there was more power than grip. When you had to set the car up, when you're underpowered and overgripped, and you just... you're stuck. Yeah. There's nothing you can do. And that's partly the problem with F1 now.
I remember when they chopped it back from 3.5 to 3. I remember speaking to you after that. And initially, you were very, very sort of downcast about this. You know, and just as people have been dropping the 10s and going to the to the 2.4 V8s. Yeah. Do you think Formula 1 is underpowered?
I don't think it's so much the power they produce is phenomenal, and those engines are incredible.
Yeah.
But it's more it's the way they have to arrange their setup with the. I mean, they've made smaller front tyres. I think that's a step in the right direction. I think when they went to narrow tyres, I mean, that there was lots of decisions that were made, but the foundations of those decisions were slightly faulty, I think, when they went to... They made certain decisions of, like, narrower tyres, narrower cars, and they were based on some really spurious kind of theories to do with being able to overtake more easily and because their cars are narrower and being able to reduce it. I'm sorry. I do... That's where I sort of fell out of bed with the mindset of people that made decisions about cars, and that's where I think drivers have got a really good part to play, because at the time you could tell these decisions were not the right decisions as far as being able to race goes. But you can't, there's no mechanism whereby you can you can impart that information into the regulations. Or the people who write the regulations. They ask designers, but of course designers are competing against each other.
Absolutely.
Drivers are too, but I think by and large drivers tend to agree on what they like to drive.
I'm going to take one more question from our listeners and readers. This is Robert King. He points out that you weren't able to defend your world championship in a Williams, having won it in a Williams. Can you shed any light, he wants to know, on why you did not stay with Williams, or you did?
He said, shifting in his chair a little bit.
It's a good thing it's not TV.
Well, I'm still not someone who is really that good at sitting down and talking money with people. I mean, it's not really kind of, some people are very good at that sort of thing. I really worked on the basis that if I win the championship, then I'll keep my job, which was a bit naive, to be honest. And it turned out to be way off.
It has a certain amount of logic to it, does it not?
Yeah, it has a sort of logic to it. Meanwhile, there were negotiations going on, and I was not completely knowledgeable of what was being said. So, I mean, I never spoke. Frank will tell you, I never spoke to him about money at all.
Who did?
I had someone who I thought was my man to do that. But Formula One is... it's complicated when it comes to contracts, money, and that sort of thing. And it was, unfortunately for me, I think the damage was done in the 95. I had a dreadful year, and I think they probably thought, well, I don't know if we can carry on with this. So
was it not, I mean, the suggestion always was that they'd actually sign Frentzen Frank does do things like that.
Well, I honestly, that's the understanding I have.
Yeah.
And I think that... I have a good relationship with Frank and Patrick and the team, and I know that they've got to do. And Frank said to me quite openly, "I've got to do what's right for the team," and that's what I've done. And I was thinking, well, could you be wrong? It doesn't seem like a very good decision. I've just won the World Championship, and I'm really on form. And how about another go? You know, but I honestly think that they had no room left. They had Frentzen signed up, and they had Jack, and they couldn't get Jack out of his contract, and all sorts of things like that. But yeah, welcome to Formula One. It's like that. I had another plan, which was which nearly came off, which is I wanted a 1-year contract, which is why I drove for Arrows. And everyone else wanted 2-year contracts, which is the irony of my career, because I only ever had a 1-year contract, and the one time I needed a 2-year contract, I didn't. Then people wanted to give me 2-year contracts, and I wanted a 1-year contract. So I wanted to drive for McLaren because Adrian was going to McLaren, and that would have been great to have had another stab in an Adrian car.
Yeah. How do you think you'd have got on with Ron?
I get on well with Ron now, but Ron, the culture there at McLaren is unique, and perhaps we talked about being able to say what you think and all the rest of it. I got the hint that I wasn't going to fit there anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't feel comfortable being gagged and stuff.
I think the fans, we're all fans, aren't we? The public, I don't know, everybody involved would love to see more drivers who actually you were quite open and quite amusing even in your heyday compared to them now. I mean, will we ever, do you think, can you see a return to that? You know Formula One so well. I mean,
I think it's in place. I mean, I think Alonso is someone who speaks his mind.
Yeah, he does.
And I think that's great. I think Montoya was another one. Absolutely. There's been a couple of drivers who we've lost, I think, who were good people for the sport. They were tough competitors, good drivers, and they just didn't like this culture where they were kind of obliged to keep their powder dry the whole time. And you know, I think that's where the public have a right to... They would understand. I mean, we've had a whole episode with Gordon Brown getting very frustrated. You know, people are human, all right? Okay, we'll give you that. If you do a good job, you're let off the occasional outburst. And we've had... Barrichello as well had his moments. Yes. They're at least Latin types, you know, they've got a lot of emotion, and that's what we want. We want to see that someone cares, that they're passionate, they're competitive, you know. And you can get the metronomic, you know, machine type player too, like you had in, you have it in tennis. You know, some people are just, and that's fine. That's their way. That's okay. But do you want the McEnroe every now and then to make it interesting too?
Sure. The interesting thing with Rubens last year, you know, after the, after that race, where he thought the teams would have lost him the race and things, he did have this outburst, but it wasn't huge on the grand scheme of things. I mean, he was obviously just a, you know, he was a bit pissed off after the race. But the amount of press coverage he got and stuff like that, I mean, it was just because it was just one thing.
It's true, Ed, but I think you know, in large part, that was because something like that is so rare now. So when it happens, the press absolutely leaps on it. Wow, controversy.
We definitely don't see the best of Alonso over here because he's so distrustful of the British media following this, the McLaren year
with Lewis.
Well, we did live in extraordinary times with the media, and that's another factor. I think I confess that I did also start to take steps to watch what I said. You know, and I realised I was actually, if you're not careful, you make it much more difficult for yourself. So you do learn your lesson. But I think there was a period where the media played the game up to a point, and now they don't. They just won't let it go, you know, whatever happens. And they've it's got to run and run because they're in such competitive times with other newspapers.
But I think it is it's partly that, Damon, but I do think it's also, well, for instance, if you go back to the Prost Senna era, I mean, there was something to write about for the papers every day, pretty much. And if you go back further to the Andretti era, everything Mario said, you know, was just gold for a journalist. So I think partly it's because of the competitive element now, but also the fact that so little, you know, of any kind of sort of with a little bit of edge, you know, comes along.
It's really difficult to go backwards, and you don't want to go backwards, you want to go forward. So
forwards in a new way, maybe. Well, didn't Tony Blair say that in 1997? He did, didn't he? The new way, third way.
Good company then.
Here's a couple of quick yes/no questions, Damon. Would you rather watch Formula One or MotoGP? Asks Alistair Warren.
Well, I would like, what I love watching with MotoGP is it was my first love, bike racing, and I had posters of bikes all over my walls, and I didn't have posters of Formula One cars, and I think part of the reason is because you can see the dynamics with a bike. It's very apparent, even in a photograph, that there's something going on, and I think that that's something that could be worked on with Formula One. In the older cars, there was much more dynamic, visible dynamic going on, both with you could see the drivers, what they were doing, and also you could see what the car was doing, and you could see the sliding. Absolutely. Now, would I like to watch an F1? I get caught up in it too. You know, I watch an F1 race, and I once you start to want someone to win, then you're hooked. And but if you don't, it can wash over you a little bit sometimes.
Well, we really are sadly out of time, I'm afraid. But thank you, everybody, for writing in. Thank you for all your questions. And most of all, of course, thank you to Damon Hill for taking the time to come in today. Best podcast ever, I reckon. Thank God for articulate, amusing racing drivers, I say. But before we go, we really ought to mention Stirling Moss, because poor Stirling has had a dreadful, dreadful accident. And for those of you who don't know about it, this happened actually at his house in his lift shaft. And but we do hear, the latest we hear today is that he is okay. He's in hospital, but he's okay. Nigel, sad news.
Oh, extremely, extremely. It's an awful thing, and he's broken his ankles, and you know, broken ankles are never simple at any age. So we just wish him all the best. He's been a great supporter of this magazine, and I think the magazine has been of him too. And there's no one like him, is there? So of course we're all very sorry, and we all say, you know, get well as soon as, Stirling.
He's a hero, Damon, there, isn't he? I mean,
utterly. You know, he epitomises really British racing driver. And very, very sorry to hear he's had this accident. So if you listen to this, Sterling, get well soon. And we are thinking of you, and we want to see you back in top form soon.
Yeah, let's hope we see Sterling at the British Grand Prix at Silverstone in the summer.
Yeah, eh? Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Right, well, we'll see you next month when we'll be back. That's me, Nigel Roebuck, Ed Foster, and our editor, Damien Smith. Bye-bye.
Motorsport Magazine, the audio podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.